Hi. Yes, that's me. I was 7 years old the first time someone called me a nigger. There on the South Florida school playground of my youth. It was said with a disquieting sense of authority and privilege. Free of the irony or sly wit of black vernacular expressions, which quite often operate multivalently, meaning one thing in one context and something else in another. To the minds of some of my white classmates, it was a declarative statement, a branding, a blot, a summation of my worth. I had heard the word used before, mostly in the Roots miniseries that chronicles the lives of American writer Alex Haley's enslaved ancestors. My parents made my older brother and I watch it each night it aired in the fall of 1977, but that word had never been applied to me. And as my clenched fist split little Bobby's lip and bruised his cheek, I was filled with a deep and abiding sense of gratification that preserved my pride, but left my soul restless. You see, his physical pain didn't satiate my emotional pain. It only hid it beneath a thin veneer of ego. I was only just beginning to learn about the power of words, about their ability to hurt or to heal, and that some are laced with a potent toxicity, the effects of which can last a lifetime. You see, it's the rust on the blade that lingers long after the knife has been drawn from the wound. It poisons the blood and pollutes one's self-perception. I did not cry that day in front of my classmates. I would not give them the satisfaction of knowing they had hurt me. But when I got home and my mother pulled me close and tried to explain the ugliness of the world, an ugliness which she tried to shield me from, but ultimately could not, I cried. I was too young to know that this was a conversation that all black mothers and fathers have with their children, a lesson, a longing, a plea, a desperate attempt to stitch caution and resilience into their sons and daughters as they learn to survive in a society engineered in part to destroy them. And as I grew and learned about the perverse nature of racism, how it operates in both covert and overt ways, and how, like a cancerous malignancy, it works its way into every part of the society in which it takes root, I began to understand that what my parents were trying to teach me above all else was how to see. Vision, a cultivated ability to perceive both the objective and the subjective reality, to see beneath the surface of appearances, and to calibrate your actions based on that information, because, in a very real sense, as a black person in America, your life depends on it. This realization was long before I ever heard the name Baha'u'llah, the Baha'i faith, long before I understood that the faculty of sight represents a dual phenomenon, one outward and one inner, long before I knew what Baha'u'llah meant when he said that the phenomenal world is a metaphor for the spiritual world, and long before I read this astonishing statement in the Baha'i writings that the black body, this black body, oscillating between points of safety and community on one hand and destruction and degradation on the other, is nevertheless endowed with a spiritual capacity unique to this revelation and independent of the abuse, the venom, and the vitriol that a sick and bewildered world would try to graft onto my being. O thou who hast an illumined heart, thou art even as the pupil of the eye, the very wellspring of the light. For God's loving rays have shed their light on your inmost being, and you have turned your face toward the threshold of your Lord. I had never heard of such a thing. In my formative years, when I was trying to craft a healthy sense of self, to combat the bigoted way the world saw me, I devoured the writings of leading black artists and intellectuals. I identified with the gritty realism of Richard Wright and James Baldwin. I appreciated the astute cultural observations of Zora Neale Hurston and the mournful and celebratory poetry of County Cullen, Claude McKay, and Langston Hughes. I, too, sing America. I am the darker brother. They send me to eat in the kitchen when company comes. But I laugh and eat well and grow strong. Tomorrow I'll be at the table when company comes. And no one will dare say eat in the kitchen then. Besides, they'll see how beautiful I am and be ashamed. I too am America. Little did Mr. Hughes know that when he first penned this moving poem in 1925, that some 15 years earlier, the leader of a just realized revelation, traveled to America from Palestine and demonstrated in a startling similar fashion the law, the spiritual law of the oneness of mankind. On April 23rd, 1912, Abdu'l-Bahá upended the conventions of segregation by insisting that a black man named Lewis Gregory, a distinguished graduate of Howard University Law School, occupy a seat of honor in the luncheon reception following his address at that same university at Washington, D.C. This simple but profoundly revolutionary act, occurring some 43 years before Rosa Parks sit in on a city bus in Montgomery, Alabama, was a clarion call to the world, a trumpet blast through time declaring in clear and emphatic language that this is a new day. In this day, every man, regardless of his complexion or social standing, every man and every woman has a seat at the table. In every dispensation, the light of divine guidance has been focused upon one central theme in this wondrous revelation, this glorious century, the foundation of the faith of God. And the distinguishing feature of His law is the consciousness of the oneness of mankind. As a multidisciplinary artist, I am always aware of the importance of sight every time I step into the studio or I'm in front of the camera. My ability to render an idea in sculptural form or to craft a character on stage is determined by it. One of the key characteristics of bigotry and hate is its blindness, a crippling myopia of the soul that makes one first see a criminal in the hooded face of a young black male, a threat to nationalist purity in the immigrant, and a challenge to male dominance in the principle of the oneness and the equality of women and men. And an outsider in a 7-year-old boy on a school playground. They whose hearts have been warmed by the energizing influence of God's creative love cherish his creatures for his sake and recognize in every human face a sign of his reflected glory. This handsome, distinguished gentleman here is my great-great-grandfather. And for much of his life, prior to the Civil War, he labored on the cotton fields of South Carolina, from sunrise to sunset, for free, with no monetary value to pass down to succeeding generations, multiplied across generations. This resulted in a wealth gap between the races of staggering proportions. The average white household has accumulated wealth 7 times the average African-American household, a direct result of slavery, Jim Crow, discriminatory housing and hiring practices that we're still afflicted by to this day. I sometimes wonder how he saw himself in relation to the larger society. Did he know that despite the brutal circumstances of his life, that he nevertheless represented the pupil of the eye, the apparatus through which light enters the soul? In one of his most moving tablets, Baha'u'llah, the manifestation of God on earth and the revealer of an independent, divinely revealed religion, assumes the position of certitude in answer to a request for freedom by an enslaved African. Oh my God, since he hath asked this for his freedom, I call thee to witness at this moment this servant that I verily have set him free in thy path, liberated him in thy name, and lifted from his neck the shackles of certitude, that he may serve thee in the daytime and in the night season, whilst thou pray that thou mayest never free mine own neck from the chain of thy certitude. This verily is my highest hope and my supreme aspiration. And to this thou thyself art a mighty witness. As we all work individually in our own lives and collectively in communities to free ourselves of the stain of racism, to cast off the shackles of bigotry and injustice, and to labor voluntarily in the holy vineyard of true freedom and human dignity, let us join hands and lift our voices to sing of a purer version of freedom. Not one polluted by the vices of materialism and excessive individualism, but a freedom purified by God's love, by God's grace, by God's justice, by God's mercy, and by God's forgiveness. And then and only then will the timeless words of Dr. Martin Luther King ring out with a new truth. We are all caught in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied together forever in a single garment of destiny. Whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly. For some strange reason, I can never be what I ought to be until you are what you ought to be. No man is an island unto himself, each man a piece of the continent, a part of the whole. And then he goes on towards the end to say, any man's death diminishes me, for I'm involved in mankind. Therefore, never seek to know for whom that bell tolls. It tolls for thee. Thank you.